Big thanks to you, Darren, and all the gang on 2FM. It is Tuesday, the 4th of March, and you're listening to Game On with Marie Crowe. Coming up between now and the new music show with Dermot O'Brien at 7pm, Paul Corry and Mark Langdon join us to talk Champions League with tonight's action already underway. Former Donegal footballer and Irish rugby player Nora Stapleton is in studio to discuss her role with Sport Ireland during Women in Sport Week. And with less than a week to go to Cheltenham, Don McLean is in studio to bring us a day-by-day preview for the 2025 festival. If you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552 or you can WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Yeah, lots coming up in the show today. We have a live sport. We actually have a live sport already underway with that Champions League I mentioned, Club Brugge and Aston Villa. Paul Corry is going to sit across the hour for us and keep us up to speed on what's happening. 21 minutes on the clock in that one. And Paul, lots has happened already.
Yeah, it has, Marie, and hopefully it's an indication of what we're in store for later in on this evening. But it is 1-1 after 21 minutes, like you mentioned. Aston Villa went ahead after 3 minutes. It was a really simple set piece. One floated to the back post. Tyrone Mings did brilliantly well to knock it down, and Leon Bailey stroked it home. But Club Brugge got back level after 12 minutes. Really good move down the left-hand side, and De Kuipier finished past Martinez. So, yeah, listen, it's been really open. Marcus Rashford has been particularly good for Aston Villa.
Strange. United fans won't want to hear that.
It's so strange. I was just saying to you off air that Marcus Rashford on loan from Manchester United, Axel Disasi on loan from Chelsea, the so-called big clubs, and they're the ones playing in the Champions League with Aston Villa. But there's plenty of goals left in this tie. Club Brugge have obviously met Aston Villa already in the league phase when they beat them 1-0 at home. So we'll see how we get on. But I'd be surprised if this was to finish 1-1, given that it's the amount of chances we've had in the opening 20 minutes.
Yeah, sounds good. There's three games on this evening. Borussia Dortmund and Lille, PSV against Arsenal. Real Madrid taking on Atletico Madrid. They all kick off at 8 o'clock. And we're going to preview them in just a few minutes with Mark Langdon. But just a word on the League of Ireland last night, Paul. Another really good round and a very surprising looking league table. Waterford sitting at the top. Then you've Drogheda United in two. And then the bottom is really where it's fascinating. Shamrock Rovers rooted to it in 10th position. And it's Derry City that are in 9th. So it's not going to script so far anyway.
Yeah, where do you start really? Like, Shamrock Rovers, I think a lot of people would have been thinking that the fixture last night was the one where they'd maybe bounce back from some of the disappointing results that they've had in Europe and the opening games of the season, but it wasn't to be. I was delighted for Johnny Russell because he puts in so much hard work at Sligo Rovers, and they constantly lose their best players. If you think of the players that left the building from the end of last season to now, it's so difficult for him to blow the squad together and be as competitive as maybe some of the other teams in the division. But, you know, two really well worked goals. They've brought in a set piece coach there, Marie, and it paid off.
Arsenal style.
Yeah, the second goal was really well worked. It was a ball hung up to the back post. Reece Hutchinson pulled it across, and John Mahon, who missed, I'm pretty certain it was all of last year, on the score sheet to get them over the line. But there has to be alarm bells going off in Tala at the moment. I know they're missing a lot of players. Danny Mandrew, Jack Byrne, Trevor Clark. Graham Burke was only fit enough to come off the bench, but there's an absence of threat in the final third. It's a lot of pressure to be putting on young Michael Noonan at 16 years of age to lead the line for such a big club who's been so used to winning over the last number of years. But not just Noonan, they don't have the same sort of width. They don't have the same sort of power in wide areas where they've scored a lot of goals in the last number of years. They don't have a focal point from a centre-forward perspective. And they don't carry the same sort of what's the word I'm looking for? A threat, really, from previous years. I think there was a fear when sides played Shamrock Rovers in recent years, and I'm not sure that's there right now.
I'd say there's alarm bells ringing in a few clubs, Paul, though, when you look at results even from last night. Pat's beaten Derry City and Drogheda as well, getting one up on Bowes. Like, these are the bigger clubs that you'd expect to be further up the table.
Yeah, and Bowes have a terrible record at home, Marie. They've only won one game at home in the league since April of last year. And that is a club that is selling out Daly Moon Park on a weekly basis, and they're really struggling. There seems to be an anxiety almost when they're playing at home that they can't seem to get over the line. And Alan Reynolds has brought in a number of different players. They've obviously brought in Colin Whelan and Moussa at the top end of the pitch to try score a couple more goals. But it's not happening for them. And that was a common trend that we saw last year, where they'd get themselves into decent positions but didn't have that killer threat to put it away. And unfortunately, they look as if they're conceding soft goals. So it's very much a case that Bows need to get back to basics, and they need to do that quite quickly, because if they don't, there'll be a lot of people pointing at the squad, at the management team, saying you've had a full pre-season together, you've had a long period of time now to work with these players, and the results aren't being seen on the pitch. So they have to get back to basics and start grafting out results. But for Kevin Doherty, I mean, at the beginning of the season, I tipped that Drogheda might struggle purely on the basis of resources.
You weren't on your own now, to be fair.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they are on an incredible run. I mean, four games played and they've only conceded one goal. To give you some perspective on that, Drogheda had the worst defensive record in the league last year. So the work that has been done there to become a difficult outfit to break down is huge kudos to Kevin Doherty and his side. But they're also carrying a threat at the top end of the pitch. And the experience that they have there, they've been almost in difficult situations previously before, and they've managed to graft out performances and results and points on the board. And they've continued the beginning of this season in the sense of, you know, where they left it off last year. And it's very early doors. You know, you speak about Shamrock Rovers and alarm bells. I'm only saying that in the sense that they don't seem to be far in the same way as they were previously. And for Drogheda, they won't be getting too carried away. It's only four games in, 8 points on the board, still a lot of games to go.
Yeah, a couple of injuries can make such a huge difference in that situation. But look, fair play to Waterford beating Cork City 2-1 last night. And I don't think anybody can begrudge Padraig Amond having another good season at 36 years of age, been around the block. You've played against him. I'd say nearly everyone's played against him at some stage. But it's great to see him still doing it. And you can just see the pride he has in playing the League of Ireland as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And Podge wasn't probably a player who was going to pull away from you over 10 yards throughout his career. He was very much basis gamer and kind of sharp movements and being clever and cute around the box. And that was very much evident in the first goal that he scored last night. His movement, Marie, is something that maybe goes under the radar, but he's offside. He gets himself back into an onside position off the shoulder of the centre half, and the ball from McDonald is good, but the finish is so cute to just guide it into the bottom corner. And you feel like if Waterford can supply the likes of Ammons and the likes of Tommy Lonergan, there's goals at the top end of the pitch for them. And Conan Noonan, a lot of people have said it and have marked it out as how good he has been since he's come in on loan from Shamrock Rovers. Like, he brings a lot of energy to their play. But Padraig Amond was instrumental in the first goal in scoring it, but the second, he put in a really decent ball to the back post, and actually Troosten goals for Cork City did really well to save the initial effort. And it was followed up then by Kyle White, who put them 2-1 ahead. And to be honest with you, I thought they fully deserved it. I know Cork were down to 10 men. Anderson got sent off. But I thought Waterford, once they went 1-0 behind, Alex Nolan scored a brilliant goal for Cork. I must point that out. Mm-hmm. Brilliant, brilliant goal. Chopped the fullback inside out. He had an opportunity to put them 2-0 up. And if he did...
Oh, and it was a bad miss.
If he did,
yeah,
it might have been a different story. Mm-hmm. But after that moment, I felt as if Cork lost control of the game, and Waterford did very well to kind of dictate the tempo and dictate possession. And once they got the early goal in the second half, I thought there was only going to be one team that was going to go on and win it.
Yeah, and Tim Clancy was very frustrated after as well. Right, we're going to move on now. Mark Langdon has joined us on the line. Oh, he's not there yet. When we talk about Tim Clancy then for just a second, Paul, because he was a frustrated figure after the game.
Yes, he certainly was. That's one way of putting it. And he was very frustrated with, I guess, the sending off, but he thought there was inconsistencies in some of the decisions that were being made. And ultimately, I guess this comes down to the result. I think if his team didn't concede in the 87th minute, maybe he might not have had the same sort of level of anger that he did at the tail end of the match. But yeah, I don't want to jump too quickly on officials' backs. I think they've had a pretty rough time of it over the last 12 months. We're calling for standards to be better. I'm not sure there was too many bad decisions. I thought Anderson's sending off, maybe the second yellow was a little harsh, but the first tackle was a pretty poor one. And the second one, I think a lot of referees would have given that sending off, but the exchange and the interview off the back of it was certainly an interesting one.
Yeah, and it was entertaining as well. Let's stick with referees, though. Mark Langdon has joined us now on the line. How are you, Mark? Hello, Mark. No, we don't have Mark. We'll come back in to him in just a minute. Sure, we'll put it to you, Paul. I was going to ask him about Michael Oliver and the Arnie slot situation. So, like, we're talking about people getting a rough time of it. Michael Oliver and Arnie Slot have a bit of beef now. I think it was I thought it was quite entertaining as well that we actually got to hear what Arne Slot said to Michael Oliver. And
again, this comes off the back of a late equaliser. You know, emotions,
frustration,
are,
yeah.
Emotions are so high, and you know, managers are very quick, I guess, to get over to officials and give them a sense of what they think of maybe some of the officiating that happened during that game.
So what he's blaming, he says if they don't win the league, he's going to effing blame you, he said to Michael Oliver. So I was really surprised more that Slot would react like that, because we do get this, I guess, a perception of him as being very cool, very calm, collected, not losing his cool at all. But it just shows there. It's almost like, you know, you're the duck, but furiously you're paddling under the water.
I think he is a cool character, probably 99% of the time. But for anybody who's managing or anybody who's playing at that elite level, Marie, there is a fierce competitive edge to these people. And sometimes in situations like that, for either your manager or player, you're better off just taking yourself down the tunnel, because there's so much emotion attached to particularly a Merseyside derby and drawing and losing 2 points in the dying embers of that game. But the good news for Michael Oliver is Liverpool are going to win the league, so
he's safe enough.
He should be safe.
Mark Langdon is with us as well. Mark, we were just talking about, I don't know if you heard, I was talking about Arne Slot there and getting a bit of insight into what was actually said between himself and Oliver, and it's getting quite the headlines today.
I tend to think this is sort of happening all over Europe. I don't know if you saw the sort of scenes in France from the weekend when Paolo Fonseca, the former Milan coach, went head to head with a referee, and at one stage looked like he was going to headbutt the referee, and could be facing a ban of anywhere between sort of a month to 7 months on the touchlines. I mean, it is a very passionate game, and you know, nobody wants to take that away from football. I think it's what sort of separates it from a lot of other sports. And I know it's difficult in the heat of the moment for managers to keep their cool, but it feels like there's kind of been a line crossed in certain aspects. I think now, Jose Mourinho has got himself into a whole heap of trouble with Turkish referees this season, to the point where, you know, last week's game against Galatasaray couldn't even be refereed by a Turkish ref. They had to bring somebody in from abroad to do it. There was a threat from the French referees to take the Marseille president to court after he alleged corruption from referees. I'm not sure if VAR has just made everything so much worse in terms of the vitriol, really, that is heading towards officials now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I might retract. All
the staff have those iPads, don't they? They all have iPads, so they're able to instantly see feedback of what the decision has just been made. So I actually agree with that.
Yeah, it's hard to be a referee. Some good games on tonight. PSV and Arsenal. All eyes will be on that one. How much, Mark, do Arsenal need to have an extended run and potentially win a Champions League, given how they seem to have faltered a little bit in the Premier League?
Yeah, I think it is really important for them. Obviously, not easy to win Champions League. There's a lot of good teams in it. But, you know, Arsenal, from where they kind of expected to be in the Premier League this season, you know, maybe they felt, you know, second now wouldn't be that bad, but it's the distance that they've got, to Liverpool. Looks like their season could fall apart. If they were to go out of the Champions League, I think questions would seriously be asked of Mikel Arteta and whether he was the right person to take Arsenal to that next step. And yet they've got this two-legged tie where they're big favourites against PSV. If you win that, you're in the quarterfinals of the Champions League. And, you know, the whole season can look very different. Mm-hmm. If you want one more win and it's not the worst draw possible, then, you could be then in a semi-final. So I think the Champions League is absolutely massive for Arsenal, and they're kind of, you know, people are going to draw very big conclusions from what happens from now until the end of the season, I think, with Arsenal and Mikel Arteta on what they do in the Champions League. You know, if they were to reach a semi-final or final, I think that a lot of what happened in the Premier League this season will or could be forgiven. If they go out now or even in the quarterfinals, you know, there will be a lot of people asking if he's the right person to lead them forward.
Paul, just given everything that has happened with Arsenal over the last few weeks, what would success be for them this season then?
Oh, good question. I mean, they're on the really tricky side of the draw. So if they beat PSV, they play Real Madrid or Atletico Madrid. And then the winners of that will then play, you would imagine, Paris Saint-Germain or Liverpool. So it's going to be a really difficult journey if they are to get to the final of the Champions League. But to Mark's point, like, there's so much made of the progress that Arsenal have made and the lack of trophies that they've won along the way. So at some point, Arteta is going to have to get that monkey off his back. I know he's, you know, won an FA Cup along the way and a Charity Shield, but he does need to start winning maybe some of the major trophies. So progressing past PSV is an absolute minimum. I think if you come up against Real Madrid and if they play well over two legs and ultimately go out, I think a lot of fans would maybe not accept that, but would probably just get on with things given the record that Real Madrid have. But yeah, listen, I don't know to the answer that question, really, because so much depends on who goes through out of these rounds. And maybe if you're playing Atletico Madrid in a quarterfinal, you expect to go through. Playing Real Madrid, maybe not so much. But they have to go through over two legs against PSV. Like, there's absolutely no doubt.
What could possibly go wrong, Paul?
Exactly, yeah.
Mark, the big one really, though, is Real Madrid against Atletico Madrid. So much history between these two. Do Atletico Madrid have enough in them, do you think, to be able to challenge this star-studded Real Madrid team?
I think it's one of the worst draws that Real Madrid could have possibly got. Atletico are, in many respects, the perfect opponent to sort of nullify Real Madrid. They will sit deep. They're not going to allow Vinicius and Mbappe the space that kind of Man City did. They've had a couple of draws against them already this season, so they're not afraid of them. You know, they are more than comfortable with their position as underdogs. They're going to fight and make it horrible for Real Madrid. They haven't got as many stars, but even last week they went to Barcelona in the first leg of the Spanish sort of semi-finals of the Copa del Rey. And at one stage, they were 4-2 down, looked like the game was getting away from them, and they still managed to come back and drew that one 4-4. Very uncharacteristic, you know, that they were involved in such a high-scoring game. I'm not expecting that, but Real Madrid have to be favourites because of the talent they've got and their record in this competition. But I would not be surprised at all if Atletico beat them over two legs, which is why I was alluding to the fact that why it looks tricky for Arsenal, if it does become PSV and then Atletico Madrid, it's not the worst kind of path towards the semi-finals. And that's why I was sort of saying the draw could play into hands, because I think over two legs, Atletico might do Real Madrid.
Paul, there's lots of different ways to play football. The two contrasting styles, philosophies, whatever way you look at it, it does make for really intriguing viewing, though.
Yeah, it does. And when Real Madrid click and going forward, they could be such a brilliant team to watch. And I'm just looking at the starting lineup. They've gone with their front three, Rodrigo, Mbappe and Vinicius Jr. So you can expect, I guess, fireworks if they do click going forward. And we saw so much of that when they played against Man City. And it feels like when it comes to this time of year, particularly in this competition, Real Madrid really do get going. But they're going to find it tough. Like, Atletico Madrid, unlike maybe some of the other teams in this competition, will know Real inside out. They're used to playing them in domestic competitions, so that gives them a bit of a leg up maybe on some of the other sides. And listen, we know what to expect with Simeone. I'm not sure if you saw him going absolutely bananas on the weekend when Conor Gallagher made those two late tackles. It's all blood and passion and you know, really putting a graft in for the side. So you would expect Real Madrid, with the quality that they have, to be able to open up Atletico over the course of two legs. It's just whether or not they're going to be able to shut out the likes of Julian Alvarez at the top end of the pitch and just see them through over the course of two legs. But with Ancelotti's record, with Real Madrid's record in this competition over the last couple of years, irrespective of who they're playing, maybe outside of Liverpool, I would expect Real Madrid to go through over two legs.
The other one then, Mark, is Borussia Dortmund against Lille. Is it a case that we're going to maybe see some of the most exciting young talent, the future of the game in these two teams?
Yeah, I mean, they've both got good players. So, you know, from Dortmund's point of view, though, we haven't seen it too often this season in the wrong half of the Bundesliga table. They have improved since Nuri Sahin was sacked as manager. They brought in Kovac, who's much more experienced and seems to have steadied the ship. But I wouldn't... You know, I quite like Lille. Jonathan David up front in the last year of his contract, probably going to go on to bigger and better things come the end of the campaign. They've had a brilliant sort of Champions League so far. They've beaten Real Madrid. They've beaten Atletico Madrid, two teams that we were just talking about and how good they both are. They absolutely smashed Bayern, all put six past them, and then final made it through against Milan into the last 16. So always difficult having to go to Dortmund and play in that intimidating atmosphere in front of the yellow wall. But little shown this season, they're more than capable, and might be an upset over the two legs. I know most people will probably fancy Dortmund just because of their sort of better and superior European pedigree. But I think what I've seen of both teams this season, I'd probably favour Lille.
Mark or Paul?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, the winner of this competition certainly isn't going to come from this tie. But yeah, you would expect, I would have thought, Dortmund over the course of two legs, irrespective of their domestic form, to get through. But yeah, it hasn't been plain sailing. Obviously, changing a manager, players maybe not hitting the same sort of heights that they have done in recent years. Sometimes the distraction of European football can just get a little extra tick out of the squad, and you would expect that they would go through over two legs against Lille.
And just on our usual European football slot, Mark, the La Liga are having a proper title race, which is nice.
They are, yeah. So Real Madrid were beaten at the weekend, actually, by Betis, 2-1. So a kind of slip up from them, and Barcelona smashed Sociedad, who were down to 10 men for a long time in that game. But yeah, I mean, where we've got kind of, you know, a lot of leagues, the Premier League being the obvious one, that you know, is all over, really. In Spain, only 3 points separate the top three. Barcelona top on 57 points, Atletico second on 56. Real Madrid down in third spot at the moment with 54 after that defeat to Betis. Now, if you speak to any Madrid fan, they'll tell you it's because of refereeing decisions, and then we'll go back to how sort of started here, and Real Madrid have been really unhappy with kind of some of the refereeing calls over recent weeks. But you know, they find themselves in a really sort of difficult position at the moment. It might come down to who kind of goes furthest in the Champions League, because if Atletico Madrid go out and Barcelona and Real Madrid go through and could end up playing each other in the Champions League final, maybe those extra games and that distraction might enable Atletico to, you know, to kind of get one up in terms of them domestically. But at the moment, Barcelona do look like the best team. They scored 71 goals, and I fancy them to go all the way in the Champions League as well, actually. We haven't spoke about that half of the draw, but I like Barcelona this season.
Could you imagine that final?
Where's it on?
The Bernabeu, I think, is it? Is it, Mark?
The final's in Munich. Munich, okay. Champions League.
Okay, Mark Langdon, thank you so much for all of that. It's coming pretty quick, all right. We'll know a lot more over the next few weeks. Thank you, Mark, and we'll be previewing tomorrow night's games tomorrow as well and reflecting on these. Paul, that Club Brugge-Aston Villa game, any change?
Still 1-1. Martinez pulled off a really good save probably about 5-10 minutes ago to keep us at 1-1. But Club Brugge have been decent. Watched them a couple of times. They were impressive against Man City at the Etihad. Obviously beat Aston Villa earlier on in the year. They're very well set up, Murray. And maybe, you know, when you look at two sides, you expect that Villa maybe should go through over the course of two legs. But this is a very close tie.
Okay, we'll be keeping an eye on that. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with those, because Nora Stapleton, the Women in Sport lead with Sport Ireland, is going to drop in to chat to us all about the exciting things that are happening during this Women in Sport week.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Now, welcome back. Nora Stapleton, who is the Women in Sport lead with Sport Ireland, has joined myself and Paul in studio. How are you, Nora?
I'm great, thanks, Maria.
I know it's a very busy week for you, so thank you so much for coming in, because it is Women in Sport week, and I'm seeing so much visibility for it online, just even been out and about, and a lot of initiatives, people going, doing things from taking part in competitions to going for a walk. So it's kind of spanning across a lot of generations. But just tell us a little bit about it and why it's so important.
Yeah, no, look, it's brilliant to talk about it. And as you said, I can't keep up with everything on social media. I'm just stuck looking at all the events taking place. We created it 5 years, so this is the fifth year of Women in Sport Week. We created it off the back of the Women in Sport policy as a way of spotlighting what's happening across the country, spotlighting the great work that the national governing bodies and local sports partnerships are doing. And then, of course, you know, we try to use it as a way of highlighting just really amazing role models, not just the fantastic athletes that, you know, we're now seeing seeing a lot more, thankfully. But also the coaches, the referees, officials, you know, the volunteers who are the ones out lining the pitches and keeping the teams going and things like that. So it's really across all themes of the policy, and it's a busy week, definitely.
Yeah, it really is. And I've noticed as well that there's been a big focus about supporting teen girls, because we've had so many conversations, and no doubt I've had a few of them with you as well, Nora, about trying to navigate those tricky years where girls tend to drop out of sport. I don't think anyone's given a definitive answer as to why it happens so much. It's a hard one to grasp because everybody's situation is different, but body confidence, menstruation, sports bras, information, all that sort of stuff, is they're now things that aren't taboo, and you're starting to talk about them a lot more. How important has that been, that we've opened up conversations?
Yeah, and I suppose that's one thing that we're trying to do, where it is about having the conversations and kind of putting a bit of an emphasis on some of these topics. So you talked about teenage girls. So we've got three main webinars this week. One is actually kicking off in about an hour or so. I don't know if anybody has time to log on to that, but that's a coaching webinar. So Bethany Carson is the Women in Sport Manager in Sport Ireland. She's doing amazing work. And she's going to be joined by Danielle Logue, who's a performance nutritionist, Sarah-Jane Cullen, a physiologist, and then Mark Keneally. So they're going to talk about REDS, or relative energy deficiency in sport, and they're going to talk about body composition. So that's kind of for coaches who are coaching, whether it's teenage girls or women. It's a really good webinar. But tomorrow we have a massive one around teenage girls. So we've got two webinars, Her Moves webinar. So Her Moves is Sport Ireland campaign targeting teenage girls. We created it just over a year ago now. We had a really nice video last year that kind of touched on a lot of those topics that you just mentioned. So probably some of the key ones are the shouty coach, the periods, the excuse notes that come into the PE teachers, the other stresses in girls' lives, everything that they need to balance going through puberty, you know, social media, all that, what they have to wear when they're playing sport, feeling left out, and where are those moments of having fun and things. So the Her Moves webinars, we're hosting one during the day. So a lot of schools, over 100 schools, I think, have signed up to that one. You know, we kind of said, look, it's an opportunity to bring the girls together in the schools, let them watch it together. And that's going to be focusing on, again, body image, mental cycle, sports bras. Like, how do you know if you've got the right sports bra? I mean, I was never showed, you know, yourself maybe as well. And it's
don't
so
even
important.
Know if they were a thing back then.
Yeah, like, I think we're looking at about 80% of females are wearing the wrong sports bra, you know, and it's so important. So that's going to be a really nice webinar. And then it's going to be repeated again in the evening. So a lot of clubs have signed up to
Brilliant.
That one, where again, if they're training, they might finish early or go out a little bit later, let the girls watch it. And it's suitable for the coaches and for the girls to watch. And that's kind of the key thing about Her Moves, that it's not just a campaign for teenage girls. Yes, we want to open girls' eyes to other opportunities, reframe what sport is like. You kind of said, you know, why are girls dropping out? There are loads of reasons. One of the key ones is when we ask them, you know, are you sporty? They say, nope, sport's not for me. And that tends to be because they don't see themselves as being the best, maybe on the team, or, you know, winning medals. And we're trying to say, look, sport is, if you love doing something, whether it's dancing, yoga, gymnastics, running, Gaelic football, camogie, soccer, whatever it might be, you know, you can be sporty, you can be involved in that. So the Her Moves, it's also for the adults in their lives. So the hub has loads of resources. So if you're a parent, if you're a teacher, if you're a coach, and you want more information about keeping girls in sport, then I'd say go on to hermoves.ie. And you'll find loads of resources there, or Instagram, the usual social media platforms.
From a positive perspective, you know, I mentioned that sport is normal now for girls, which is amazing, and that wasn't always the case. There might be one or two in the class that went in and played on a boys' team and then eventually graduated to finding a girls' team, whereas now you can go out of your house and turn left or right and you'll find some sort of a sport for girls, and that's brilliant. But what are the challenges? Because I'd imagine it's not all as perfect as that.
It's kind of different depending where you are in the country as well, rural versus urban. So a lot of the challenges, so in primary school, girls and boys are, you know, they take part in sport just as much as one another. And then it's that transition into secondary school. So definitely moving into first, second year. kind of exploring other sports is a challenge for them. So I said they tend to be introduced to some of the traditional sports that we have, which are amazing. You know, I played Gaelic football, I played soccer, I played camogie, I played handball, and I loved all of them, but they're just not for everybody. Mm-hmm. So some of those traditional sports, eventually girls get a little bit turned off, or it's just not for them, or they're feeling excluded because maybe their skill level, you know, mightn't be what the coach wants, and so they don't get picked, and then they're left sitting on the sidelines. So those are massive reasons. And like, we're working with the national governing bodies to create more options for the girls. So if they like basketball, maybe they don't want to commit to training twice, mm-hmm. three times a week, playing a match, but they love basketball, they love coming and playing. So we've got social basketball, and Basketball Ireland have some amazing social ball programs, both for adults but also for the teenage girls. If, for example, you know, you love swimming, but you can't commit to, what is it, 5 days a week in the pool or 9 swimming sessions in the pool, there should still be ways for those girls to swim. So the national governing bodies are now exploring these other options for the girls, which are just crucial for them.
What about coaches and getting more female coaches into it? Because I feel we've kind of seen a lot of glass ceilings smash over the last few years. But often when I see teams rocking up to play matches, I've rarely enough see female coaches on the line.
Yeah, no, and it kind of is, I suppose, as we get older through those older age groups. I mean, I'm down my local GA club now. My fella has started the nursery, and there's probably just as many of the mums as there is the dads down at that, which is great to see. Mm-hmm. So at an intro level, we're seeing a high number of male and female coaches. You know, it's not far off equal. As a base across the whole population, and across our coaching database, it's made up of about 36% females. Unfortunately, as we go through the pathway, that drops off. So when you get to high performance level, you're talking about 13%. Now, we've a lot of initiatives in there. So we do have a women in high performance coaching program, which we're running for those that are in that high performance space, to give them some support and kind of just help them kind of progress and stay within that high performance space. And then a lot of the funding that we give out. So last year, we got about 4 million from government in terms of women in sport grant funding. We gave about 3 million of that out to national governing bodies and local sports partnerships, and then they run a lot of the coaching networking days, coaching programs, etc. So we do have a bit of a way to go. But what I will say is, in the last, since the policy came in, there's been about a 10% increase in the number of women who are going on coaching courses and being certified, so that's massive progress. So they are coming into the pathway, but now we have to retain them and support mm-hmm. them as they go through.
So if anybody is looking for information about these webinars and hasn't signed up yet but wants to sign up, where do they go, Nora?
Look, you know, you can have a look in Sport Ireland social media channels, or Sport Ireland / Women in Sport, even Google Women in Sport Week 2025. I just did that earlier and it's popping up as well. So they can still register for some of them. The one webinar we didn't mention was around officiating, so breaking the barriers, women officiating, again, another key topic, really important.
We were actually talking to her a little bit earlier about refereeing, and we were saying, why would anyone want to be a referee, male or female? So that's probably a challenge in itself, but it would be great
as well.
Nora, that's brilliant. Thanks a million. Best of luck with it. I've seen it grown over the last few years, and it's really wonderful to see initiatives like this, and just to see so many girls and women getting out, exercising, finding the time for themselves, playing games, having friends, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, no, that's key. And look, the participation rate is increasing, but again, you know, our job is definitely not over yet.
Absolutely, for sure. Nora Stapleton, thank you so much. Halftime in that UEFA Champions League game between Club Brugge and Aston Villa, still 1-1. We'll be chatting to Paul Corey a little bit more about that. And we'll also have our Cheltenham 2025 preview. Can't believe it's starting next week. That's came around so quickly. Don McLean, racing journalist, will be with us very shortly.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Yeah, welcome back. Don McLean is with me in studio. We're going to look ahead to Cheltenham, which is just around the corner, starting next week. Don, it's came around really, really quickly. How excited are you to be heading over?
Yeah, look, it's brilliant, Marie. As you say, it kind of, yeah, it's happened upon us quite quickly in the end. Yeah, you're kind of watching it all year and then suddenly it's here. But yeah, in a week's time, the first day will be over. So, but look, it's, you know, it's the meeting into which the whole season funnels, really. The championship races, the Gold Cup and the champion hurdle, and the novice races, the champion chases, stairs hurdle, they're all the kind of championship mm-hmm. events. So I know, yeah, it should be a hell of a week.
What's the forecast like? Very important.
I think it's pretty good. Yeah, no, that is important. It's pretty good. So that's going to have an impact on ground conditions. I'd say in general, the ground is going to be kind of good to soft, which really should be ideal, you know, just on the soft side of good, not heavy ground like we've had for a couple of the days, or very soft ground in the last 2 years. But I think good to soft ground, you know, kind of no excuses ground. That's okay. What it should be. Yeah.
Okay, we like that, definitely. Yeah. We're getting to the big talking points in just a minute, but there are some changes as well that people should probably be aware of. Maybe outline some of them for us.
Yeah, they made changes after last year's meeting, which I think most of them were very good, Marie. Like the 2.5 mile grade one novices chase, that was taken out, replaced by a 2.5 mile novices handicap chase, which was in place up until a few years ago. And I suppose the impact that has had is it means that the top class novices, they don't have a 2.5 mile chase, a grade one chase anymore. So they have to go either for the 2 mile chase or the 3 mile chase, the Arkle or the Brown Advisory chase, respectively. And that just increases the competition in those two races. So I think that's probably good.
Yeah.
The National Hunt Chase was changed from a conditions race or a graded race to a handicap. And the National Hunt Chase, traditionally, it's an amateur riders race. So they're allowing professionals now riding the National Hunt Chase. I'm not sure about that. Like there's a history that goes with the National Hunt Chase. Like, for example, last year, Derek O'Connor nearly won. There are three amateur riders races, so there weren't until this year. He rode two winners in two of the races and finished second in the Fox Hunters. Or the Hunter's Chase. So I'm not sure that, you know, it's a tradition race. You can see why they did it. It's an odd 145 handicap now. But they call it the National Hunt Chase. It's really a different race. It's not effectively the National Hunt Chase anymore. And then they've got different stipulations for novices. They have to have one more run than they used to have had to have in order to run an open handicap. I think that's good as well, because it means that the handicapper has more evidence on which to give a horse a handicap rating. So I think in the main, the changes were good, Marie. I just thought tinkering with the tradition of the National Hunt Chase, you know, maybe that was unnecessary.
Okay, well, look, the good thing about change is something you can always change back. Exactly. So, Don, lots to get through. Let's start with Galloping Deschamps, because cusp of history, going for his third Gold Cup and name on everyone's lips, but can he do it?
Yeah, look, it'll be brilliant to see it, Marie. He's a, like, Galloping Deschamps, I suppose he's got into the public psyche now. Like the reception that he got at Leopardstown at Christmas when he won the Savills Chase, that was brilliant. And then he went back there to the Dublin Racing Festival and won the Irish Gold Cup. And that, like, it was just, you don't hear ole ole on an Irish race course normally. So they were singing ole ole when he won it. The cheer that he and Paul Townend got when he came back into the winner's enclosure was, it really was kind of spine-tingling stuff. And he's won two Gold Cups, gone for his third. Only Arkle, Best Mate and Cottage Rake, they're the only three horses who've won three Gold Cups since Golden Miller won the fifth of his five back in 1936. So it's a massive task ahead of him, but he's odds-on favourite to win it. He's the one they all have to beat. Willie Mullins reports him in top form. He's going to have Paul Townend for company. We know he loves the track. He stays. He's got pace. He jumps well. He has everything in his favour. So, yeah, he's a really worthy favourite.
Yeah, but when someone's the favourite, people love to take them down. So what about rivals?
Yeah, like Monty Starr is an interesting horse of Henry de Bromhead's. He's going to have to improve a lot on what he's done, but I think the extra trip will suit him. He's a real staying horse. You've got Corbett's Cross in there as well for Jeffrey McManus and Emmett Mullins. I think actually Galloping Deschamps' main danger is probably Banbridge. You're talking about the weather earlier on, Banbridge, Joseph O'Brien trains him. He really does need goodish ground. He got beaten in the Ryanair Chase last year on soft ground. If the ground came up soft, he might not even run. But on goodish ground, like, he won the King George. We didn't know that he stayed 3 miles until he won the King George. He stayed that trip really well. He's got an extra 2.5 furlongs to go. So we don't know if he's going to stay that. But his pedigree suggests he's got every chance of staying. He's a Cheltenham horse as well. He's a Martin Pipe Hurdle winner. He won the Arkle trial there as well as a novice. And I think if Galloping Deschamps has a danger, it's going to be Banbridge.
Okay, brighter days ahead. A lot of interest on where she would go, whether it be the champion or the mares. So confirmed now for the champion hurdles. And it's going to set up a fascinating race with Constitution Hill, Lossiemouth and State Man. Right move for brighter days ahead?
Yeah, I think so, Marie. It's brilliant that she's in the race. She really enhances the champion hurdle picture. Like the performance that she put up at Leopardstown over Christmas was phenomenal. She went fast early on and she kept up a relentless gallop. She beat State Man by 30 lengths that day. Gordon Elliott and Jigginstown House, they were kind of, the Mayor's Hurdle was always an option, and she'd be an odds-on shot for the Mayor's Hurdle. But I think it's great for racing that they've decided to go for the Champion Hurdle, because Constitution Hill, he's the Champion Hurdle winner from 2 years ago. He had his time off. He's back this year. He's won his two races. Maybe he's not quite as good as he was, but he's still very, very good. And he sets the standard. State Man is the Champion Hurdle winner from last season. Last season, top class Mary Willie Mullins as well. Like State Man, also trained by Willie Mullins. But Brighter Days Ahead, like she's a top class mare. She's going to get £7 from the geldings as well, and she's only been beaten once. That was actually at the Cheltenham Festival last year, but there was no pace in that race in the Mayor's Novices Hurdle, and she probably got undone by that, I think, with a fast run race, and it will be a fast run race, because it looks like King of Kingsfield is going to run in the race as well, and he'll set a fast pace as he did at Leopardstown. And yeah, she's just such a mare with massive potential. She, like, we don't know how good she could be, and she could be good enough to beat Constitution Hill, I think.
Has Constitution Hill shown you enough, just considering how it panned out maybe unpredictably over the last while with the timeout and now the return, to be able to challenge now with Brighter Days Ahead coming in?
Yeah, like that's the key question. Like, how close to his absolute best is Constitution Hill? Like 2 years ago, they were talking about Constitution Hill as potentially the best hurdler ever. And then he's had it, you know, he had a setback, which was a shame. But he's back now, and he's been very good this season. Maybe not quite as good as he was in his pump, but still very, very good, and still a worthy favourite for the Champion Hurdle. So it's up to the others, including Brighter Days Ahead, to get up to his level and to go and try and beat him. And I think there's a good chance she can, yeah.
It's crazy how things can change, really, isn't it? Okay, John Bond. So favourite for the Champion Chase, but has never won the Cheltenham Festival. Is this going to be John Bond's year?
Yeah, it could be, Marie. Again, he's favourite, and you can see why. I suppose just that's a bit of a niggle in the back of your mind that he's never won at the Cheltenham Festival. He's won at Cheltenham, but he's just never won at the festival, and he's never been out of the first two there. So you can argue that Cheltenham is not a negative for him, but just on the figures, his best runs have been at Sandown and Ascot, maybe Aintree as well. So back at Cheltenham, if he's ever going to win a Champion Chase, it's going to be this year, and he's a worthy favourite. You've got Solness in there as well, just for Brian's horse, Marine Nationale, who'd be a really poignant winner. Michael O'Sullivan, synonymous with Marine Nationale, and in fact the Supreme Novices Hurdle is named after Michael O'Sullivan this year, which is brilliant. And Marine Nationale does have a chance in the Champion Chase. John Bond's the one they have to beat, but I don't think he's a certainty as such in racing, yeah.
So that's the case with a lot of things, isn't it, though? So what about Tiapu? Hasn't raced since finishing second behind Lossiemouth in the Hatton's Grace Hurdle at Fairy House back in December, but he did win the Stairs Hurdle last year on the back of a similar break. Are we going to see him repeat the feat this year?
Yeah, I think, again, he's a worthy favourite, Marie. Gordon Elliott, he implemented that plan last year. He skipped all of, you know, the lion's share of the season to come to Cheltenham as a fresh horse. We know that he's the best when he's fresh, Tiapu, and he won the Stairs early, won it impressively. Same programme again this year. He was beaten by Lossiemouth, probably again outpaced by her in a solely run race. But coming on here, Gordon Elliott reports him in really good form. And yeah, he's the title holder, and he's the one they have to beat again. Home by the Lee is interesting in there. Another Joseph O'Brien horse who... He's running in, I think, his fourth Stairs Hurdle, but he just seems to be in really good form this year, so he'll be a worthy opponent for him. And Rocky's Diamond's an interesting horse of Declan Queeley's. He's a young horse. He's only a five-year-old. No five-year-old has ever won the Stairs Hurdle in its current guise, but he's a maybe a lively outsider in the race, but yeah, Tiapu sets the standard.
So let's move on then. And trainer Noel George has confirmed that L.A. Francais is 90% certain to go for the Ryanair Chase now, not the Champion Chase. How much of a big addition will he be to that?
Yeah, massive, Maria. I think it's probably the right race for him. He did have the option of the Gold Cup as well. They'd narrowed it down in the last couple of weeks to the Champion Chase or the Ryanair Chase. And the Ryanair Chase, it's kind of over the intermediate trip and extended 2.5 miles. The Champion Chase over 2 miles. So the Ryanair Chase should suit him better. He's a horse who, as we saw in the King George, he likes to get out there in front and bowl along. And yeah, he'll be an exciting addition to the Ryanair Chase. It looks like Factifile might come here as well. And he's been put in as favourite. Protectorat is the Ryanair winner from last year. The ground may be going against Protectorat. I think he's a better horse on softer ground than he is on good ground. Jella's in there as well, a likely outsider. And looks like Gaelic Warrior might come here as well. He's got the option of the Champion Chase as well. So the Ryanair Chase, as is often the case, it's kind of We're not certain of the lineup yet, because horses in it have the option of the Champions Chase or the Gold Cup, but we're getting closer to that now. It looks like Factifile is going to be favourite if he runs here, and Ile Francais will be a big opponent for him.
So the Triumph Hurdle then, there's two British trained horses. We've spoken very little about British trained horses, but La Lamba and East Indian Dock are at the top of the market for this one. Do they deserve to be ahead of the Irish horses?
Yeah, we don't know. Like with juvenile hurdlers, Maria, you kind of don't get a handle on the relative strengths of the British horses versus the Irish horses until we get to Cheltenham. They don't really take each other on. Sometimes they do in the spring hurdle, but often they don't. And that's the case this year. La Lamba and East India Dock, they've looked very good. La Lamba's a high-profile horse, has come over. East India Dock has been impressive in all he's done so far, and they're kind of joint favourites at the top of the market. But I thought Hello Neighbour, Gavin Cromwell's horse, should be closer to them in the betting than he is. Like he's only run four times. He won twice in the flat. His two runs over hurdles have been good. He won the Grade 2 Juveniles Hurdle at Leopardstown over Christmas, and then he won the Spring Juvenile Hurdle last time at the Dublin Racing Festival. And that Spring Juvenile Hurdle is often a really good pointer to the Triumph Hurdle, and he's a classy horse off the flat. He's got a rating in the high 90s. So yeah, like he wasn't overly impressive in the Spring Juvenile Hurdle, but I think the faster pace that they'll go on the Triumph Hurdle, and East India Dock, he's a horse who likes to get out in front and set a fast pace, that should suit Hello Neighbour. And yeah, I think he should be up there with the top two in the market as well.
So what else are you looking forward to, Don?
Yeah, that's what, five or six races to cover. There are 28 of them, so there's plenty more besides. Like the novices are really interesting. Kopec Debord, he's a strong or a short prize favourite for the Supreme Novices Hurdle. He was good at Christmas. He didn't jump very well. Then he jumped way better at the Spring or in the Dublin Racing Festival. And he's a worthy favourite for the Supreme Novices Hurdle. Romeo Coolio, so he's Willie Mullins' horse, Romeo Coolio of Gordon Elliott's, who finished second in the Champion Bumper last year. He's been good this season so far as well. So it should be really interesting to see those two taking each other on. I'm looking forward to seeing Majborough again over fences. He's the Triumph Hurdle winner from last year. He's run twice over fences this season. He was very good on his debut. He was good the last day. He kind of made one or two little mistakes on the run down the back straight, but he never looked like falling. And then at the third last fence, after making those mistakes, he was very, very good. And he's just a horse who could have a serious future ahead of him. Willie Mullins trains him, JP McManus owns him, and he's going to be a short price favourite for the Arkle. And you've got Ballyburn against Dancing City, and Better Days Ahead in the Brown Advisory Chase, the 3 mile novices chase. That's a really interesting race. It's a wide open race. I think there are cases to be argued for plenty of horses in the race. But yeah, and then we're on to the handicaps, which like the Irish contenders in the handicaps are strong. So yeah, there's an awful lot to look forward to.
Ruby told me that this Irish domination will be cyclical and people should enjoy it while it's here, because who knows what's around the corner. Do you agree?
I do agree. Like, you know, I remember in the late 80s when there were very few Irish winners, and the early 90s. In fact, Galmoy was the only Irish chain winner in, I think, 87 and 88. And then in 89, he didn't win. There were none. There were no Irish chain winners at the Cheltenham Festival in the late 80s. I suppose it's long enough ago, but I remember them well. And yeah, like these days, last year there were 18 Irish trained winners and 9 British trained winners. For the last two seasons before that, it was 18-10, and then the year before that it was 23 Irish winners, 5 British winners. So that was an absolute Irish domination. But before that, like in 2015, there were 13 Irish winners and 14 British winners. So, you know, it's kind of even Stephen back then. That's 10 years ago. Look, it's just, you know, as Ruby probably said to you, at the moment, the very good National Hunt horses are in Ireland. And, you know, obviously top-class trainers here, as there are top-class trainers in Britain. These things are cyclical. It's like anything. You know, when Dublin are in their pomp, you can't imagine that they won't win. Or when Man City are in their pomp, you can't imagine they won't win a league. But, you know, that
things happens.
Happen. Yeah. So, look, as Ruby said, enjoy it while it's here.
Don, thank you so much. And we'll be hearing from you throughout the festival as well on all the different platforms. So looking forward to all of that. Paul Corrie is still here. Paul, any change in that Champions League game?
No, not a huge amount to report on the Villa and Brugge game. But what I will do is give you the Real Madrid team, because that tends to be the one that people want to hear. Courtois in goal. Back four of Mendy, Rudiger, Asensio, Valverde. Midfield three of Diaz, Tchouameni and Camavinga. Jude Bellingham is, of course, suspended. Mm-hmm. And a front three then of Rodrigo, Mbappe and Vinicius Jr.
Oh, that's heavy going, isn't it?
It should be entertaining.
And just a word as well, Paul, on a couple of tomorrow night's games, because Liverpool PSG is, of course, the big one, and the reward that Liverpool got for having a great great early stages in the Champions League was a round of 16 against PSG. Doesn't seem fair.
No, do not underestimate PSG. I know we're short in time here, but they have been firing since, particularly the turn of the new year. Dembele scoring a huge amount of goals. They've Doué and Barcola at the top end of the pitch. They're a completely different outfit than the one that we saw when it was Neymar, Messi and Kylian Mbappe. This is a team who are really pulling in the same direction, and this will be a very difficult two legs for Liverpool.
Yeah, very much so, and especially with everything going on domestically as well, Paul, it's hard to keep firing on all fronts.
Yeah, there's a lot to juggle. Like, I won't be too concerned about that. I just think if I look at the teams left in the competition, Paris Saint-Germain and Real Madrid, I think, are the only ones that can really get in the way of Liverpool, and it looks like Liverpool are probably going to have to play both of them if they want to go on and win this competition. But Enrique's got a different tick out of PSG than maybe some of the other managers in previous years. Dembele has scored a ridiculous amount of goals, almost Salah-like, in the last couple of weeks. He's a real threat, and on transition, PSG can hurt Liverpool if they're not at it.
Okay, Paul, thank you for all of that. Don as well, thank you for coming in, and to our producer, Ronan Lawler and Laura Lee, who was on BCO duty. That is it for us for this evening. The music show with Dermot O'Brien is up next.
This is 2FM.